Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic on Tour. I have a very special guest for you today. He's someone who I interviewed online. I know it must have been a few years ago now, and I was overwhelmed with super chats, such that I had to ask him to stop sending them in. But now here he is in person in London, and that is the philosopher and poet and general thinker, Mr. Curtis Yarvin. Curtis, hello.
Thank you so much, Ed.
A pleasure to see you. We were at an event last night, an unheard event near Westminster Abbey, and it went rather well, I thought.
That's unheard with no A.
Mm-hmm.
And near Westminster Abbey, not in Westminster
Abbey. Near Westminster Abbey, yes.
An old Queen Street, a street whose name I naturally love. And it went quite well. Unheard, that's unheard for Americans, that's unheard without an A.
Not part of the herd.
Not part of the herd. And I thought it went rather well. I noticed that we're both, somewhat spiffy today.
Well, I think it's important. I was spiffy last night as well. I was wearing a different cravat. I think it's important to be spiffy. I think last night you were wearing one of those kind of...
The faggy European
Islamic
collars.
Sort of collars.
The faggy European collar is what we call it in America.
Yeah, because it's
the
not,
banded
it's,
collar.
It's
the
no,
banded
it's no collar.
Collar.
It's a collarless
it's
shirt.
It's a banded collar, technically. Or Mandarin collar.
Yes, Mandarin collar.
Highly preferred. You know, if you're a nerd and you want to basically spice up your look, you know... Just go and buy some banded collar shirts. I recommend banded. Just go to Amazon, search for banded collar plus linen. You'll do great.
I got one. I was at a shop in Turku in Finland, and there was a shop selling only Muslim clothes. And I purchased myself a banded collar sort of...
And you know what it goes really well with? I didn't bring mine this time. The narrow jacket.
Mm.
Yeah, the narrow jacket is really a secret fashion weapon that... And there's two kinds of narrow jackets. There's the kind that says, I am the Beatles, and there's the kind that says, I'm a Pakistani waiter. And you just have to buy it from the right kind of shop so that you don't look like a Pakistani waiter.
Unless you want to look like a Pakistani waiter.
Unless you are a Pakistani waiter.
You want to
in which case, it would be, I think, a terrible mistake to look like, you know, the manager of the Beatles.
Perhaps you want to acquire 14-year-old English girls or something like that. Assists you. Now, speaking of weapons, though, when Curtis and I last met, well, apart from last night, it was at a conference in London in October, November, and we agreed that when Curtis comes on again, we would talk about, as there should be one every 100 years, the next war, the next revolution, particularly vis-a-vis America. And, of course, things have moved on since then. Now we have what's just happened. I mean, they've just shut down Lauren Chen and a load of other YouTubers for criticizing Kamala Harris. Mm. I mean, it's 2020 all over again.
With Russian money, I may add, although, you know, it's considered very meritorious for us to fund Russian dissidents. But, you know, the basic rule, the fundamental principle, Ed, of the global American empire, a.k.a. gay, is the turnabout is not fair play.
No. So there can really be no dramatic change. But research by this guy that I've talked about on my channel, Mietinen, and also by that Russian fellow, Peter Turkin, it also by my own genetically influenced stuff, indicates there should be, and perhaps we are on the cusp of, some kind of dramatic, some kind of shift. And the fact that I see more and more women in based circles implies to me as well that there may be some kind
of vibe shift. The famous vibe shift, basically, the phrase vibe shift is due to my friend Sean Monahan and, also the founder of Normcore. He's a trend spotter. And he was like, there's a vibe shift.
Mm-hmm.
And you're absolutely right that, you know, there's actually, you know, I'm glad you talked about this, Ed, because it really affects your sort of core discipline of evolutionary psychology. And what evolutionary psychology tells us is that there's two kinds of good parties. One is the kind of party where there are hot girls, and the other is the kind of party where there are no hot girls, but there should be hot girls. and you know, really finding that first kind of party where you're you know, and that's a scene that is ready to burst loose. The hot girls are not there yet. But if they were there, they would find that they like it.
Right, but I'm finding that the events I go to over the last 5 years, there is the hot girl to man ratio is increasing.
Like, it is not high. It is not a high ratio.
It's not high.
It is not high, but it is increasing.
From a low base point.
Yes.
But the hot girl level is increasing.
Now, there's a confounding factor, of course, which is a factor that, you know, is very near and dear to me personally, which is Ozempic. And Ozempic, you know, and I think Ozempic is really...
Have you been on that, have you?
I prefer to say I've been, you know, when people ask me why I'm so looking so slender and fit, what I tell them, and anyone can use this bit, you know, what I tell them is I've been training for the Ozempics. I'm joining the quest for Ozempic gold. And yes, it's a marvelous, marvelous drug.
What about just the idea of just less cake, more salad?
Salad is disgusting.
Well, that is true.
You know, Ozempic will make you eat less of everything.
Less cake, more Ozempic.
Or you'll regret it, you know.
Right, right.
I refer to it as Zemping.
It causes you physical pain if you eat too much.
A little bit of bloating, a little bit of, you know, like various indescribable things, yes.
I think it means diarrhea or something. It's
the least of it.
All right, well, okay, so you... So the Ozempics is going well, the girls will get hotter presumably because of that as well.
Indeed, 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 and so will the men, although it matters less. But you know, with a little bit of pudge here, you know, it can go away very quickly with a few injections. You know, although you have to build up with the Ozempic, you start with sort of low doses, and you end up at these heroic doses in the milligram range. You know, and. It's quite a, you know, one of the things you can do, or, you know, the thing that I do, being, you know, of the Semitic persuasion, I love to save money, and Ozempic is not inexpensive. You can order the research peptide from peptide, you know, disposals. Of course, this is a research peptide, not for human use, not for animal use, only for your scientific experiments.
Not all human use. So it's what plants that want to be thin.
Yeah, plants that want to be thin, or your scientific experiments, whatever these may be. And you have to check a little box saying that you're a scientist doing science. And then they'll ship you this little vial of semaglutide. And, you know, it costs $80 instead of $2,000. Moreover, from the same sources, you can get even more advanced peptides, the futuristic peptides, still in FDA testing, that act on not one system, but two or three. You know, these will make you skinny as a rail. These will make you, you know, look like, you know, make Auschwitz look like Oprah, you know, like, you know. Sorry. Spicy, I know.
Well, Oprah goes up and down though, doesn't she?
She
oscillates between Auschwitz and the sort of the South Sea Islands.
Exactly, exactly. Like, you know who's become thin, presumably, through training for the Ozempics is Roseanne. Roseanne Barr is a thin woman now.
Mm.
It's amazing.
And she was, of course, cancelled, Roseanne Barr. We go back to the central issue. When we were there, anyway, this conference.
This was ARC.
Yes,
we left at ARC.
Did you
watch the Jordan Peterson speech at ARC?
You may recall that we left the room.
Yeah, well, that's right. We did, but we saw some of it. We saw some of it, and I can't. Can I resist doing my Jordan Peterson impression? Ideas are the same thing. There's values.
How are you fighting rape? How are we defining having a hoe?
I can't resist doing this other bit on camera, which is a bit devised by my my good Hollywood friend, Hadrian, who came up with this, also a canceled man.
Is that the chap I met yesterday?
Yeah, lovely chap. And Hadrian came up with this lovely film concept that, like all bad Hollywood film concepts, is precast. Mm-hmm. Could never happen. This could never happen. But everyone who I say this to is like, oh my God, this has to happen. So picture in your mind Steve Coogan as Jordan Peterson. Steve Coogan as Jordan Peterson. Then picture in your mind George Clooney as Hunter Biden. And they're together in a rehab in Serbia. And they break out and find life and love on the road, and it's called Bucko.
Who would play Michaela Peterson?
That's interesting. Who will play Michaela Peterson? How about Sydney Sweeney?
Okay. we discussed this, and I said that all of the the data, all the research, all of the attempted prognostications of what will occur indicates that there should be at some point, really quite soon, some kind of massive breakdown in America, some kind of revolution, some kind of war.
Couldn't disagree more.
And you couldn't disagree more. So what based on what's going on, are you auguring is going to occur?
Well, you know, there's a great line from the best movie about Wall Street ever made, which is Margin Call, an absolutely fabulous movie. And there's a cameo, almost a bit part in there, played by Jeremy Irons, who's playing essentially a character who is Dick Fuld. And he's great. You know, he's like, you know, do you know why they pay me so much money? He's like, they pay me so much money because I have a crystal ball and I can see what is going to happen. And gentlemen, right now, when I look into my crystal ball, I see nothing at all. And so, you know, like, I think it's absolutely, you know, no one can predict who is going to win this election. You know, I can sort of barely call the American electoral process has become so strange that you can barely call it an election. And my feeling and my guess is that Kamala Harris is going to win the election. And I'll tell you why. Because I believe, are you familiar with Moore's Law, Professor Dutton?
I've heard of Moore's Law.
Moore's Law tells us that the feature size on the on semiconductors halves every year and a half. And what's fascinating, I think that's the number, and what's fascinating is that this law is maintained by like hundreds, thousands of different little innovations going on every year, tightening the process, improving the process. Some say that Moore's Law is ending, it's running out of speed. I'm not sure about that. But I believe that there's a Moore's Law of what we call in America election fortification. Are you familiar with the concept of election fortification?
Elaborate on it. From my view.
So there was a wonderful piece after the 2020 election, which of course was won certifiably without any scientific doubt whatsoever by my personal hero, Joseph Robinette Biden. And there was a great piece after this election that was described in perhaps too much detail how our democracy had been defended from the barbarian Trump. And it used the term the election had been fortified. And the way in which you fortify an election is simply that you find votes. And America, especially since COVID, has developed a system of elections which is very, very good at finding votes. It's very good at taking people who have absolutely no interest in political participation. And in terms of the philia that Aristotle described as an essential aspect of citizenship, they're absolutely devoid of national feeling and they don't care. But they care about simple things closer to them, ties of community and family, and of course, money. And so people go around with ballot papers and find these people and harvest, as they say, their ballots. And so I don't know that ballots corresponding to no one are exactly printed. I wouldn't necessarily go that far. I would say that the American electoral system has been beautifully designed, has been beautifully fortified, so that it is almost impossible to produce. There's no evidence of fraud. Okay. There's no evidence of any, you know, significant voter fraud in American elections. However, the system is designed so that there can be no evidence. And so you have a system of basically, and bear in mind, this is the leader of the free world. This is the most powerful nation in the world, the nation of the atomic bomb, the moon rockets, the space shuttle, you know, Starlink. And in this nation, no one other than God, who can see every sparrow, knows how many people are in the country to within 10 or 20 million. Moreover, this is a country in which the rule of not just of law, but of order has broken down so completely that I saw a recent Gallup poll, which contained a wonderful statistic. 40% of Americans are afraid to walk at night near their homes. Truly astounding situation. And so, you know, the idea of elections and democracy in this like vat of bubbling chaos is just astounding. And in that astounding situation, Moore's law of election fortification tells us that the technology of fortifying an election, the technology of harvesting ballots, is going to improve in every election by 10 or 20%. That's my feeling. And the way that works is rather interesting because, of course, there are polls that predict elections. But actually, the polls are sort of designed in terms of who they sample, that a good poll is one that gets the same results as the election results. So if the vote harvesting improves by 10%, they have to jank their sample up to sample 10% more Democrats or Republicans if the Republicans were vote harvesting, but the Republicans have no idea how to tie their shoes. And
they managed to win the 2016 election.
It was very early in the technology of vote fortification.
Okay.
And that took quite a few people by surprise, and there was, you know, essentially a red surprise in the balloting there. However, you know, for example, if we look at the 2022 midterms, we notice a rather striking effect in the state of Florida. We see that Florida became sharply more conservative, to the point where formerly a swing state has become a deep red state. This is a result of Floridians' tremendous respect for the work of Governor DeSantis, very popular man leading a sweeping movement. It could be that, or it could be the fact that Governor DeSantis cracked down on vote fortification. And the result of Governor DeSantis cracking down on vote fortification was, I'm not saying it still doesn't happen, but, you know, he put some work into it and made it more difficult, was approximately a swing of perhaps 10% in the vote. So, you know, that is essentially, you know, kind of the margin of difference here. You've got to get basically 10% more lazy, grill-tending Americans to the polls, you know, where they actually vote in person as though it was like the 17th fucking century or something. Is this a family podcast or can I swear?
It's a certain kind of family.
Okay. Fuck yeah. And so, you know, my feeling, you know, Republicans insist on living in a world where it's still, if not the 17th century, at least the 19th century. And, you know, an election is some kind of Norman Rockwell experience where, you know, you care about the issues and, you know, you vote depending on the issues and the quality of the candidates. Frankly, it's retarded. And, you know, this is a retarded way to vote. The actual way to vote is, how do I give as much power to my people as possible?
Yeah.
And the Democrats understand this perfectly. And the Republicans are like little babies, you know. And so my prediction is that, you know, the polls are going to have the actual election results, which, of course, can come in, you know, votes start being cast, I think, a week or two from now and can continue to be cast, I believe, up to a week after the election. Again, this is why I use the word election in sort of a strange sense, because it's really, you know. And so, you know, you do this strange thing.
Well, they're allowed to cast votes almost a month and a
yes.
half.
Yes. But prior to the election, this is called early voting. And in the counting of mail-in ballots that were issued, you know, can be received up to a week and a half after the election, I believe. I don't know. Wouldn't swear to that.
Absolutely preposterous.
It's absolute. It's amazing. There's this great clip. I think it's a CNN or maybe ABC clip from maybe the 2020 or 2022 election where they have these ballot boxes. And, you know, to stuff a ballot box, you used to have a some kind of official position, but they installed these ballot drop boxes in public places. And so that to make it very easy for, you know, minorities who, as you know, are very, very feeble and, you know, need a lot of help because they have IQs in the 20s or 30s to cast these, you know, their votes. It should be made as easy as possible. And so this ABC reporter, I think it was, is filming one of these drop boxes, and, you know, a BIPOC approaches and to cast a vote, and the camera turns on her, and, you know, here's this, you know, this nice lady casting her vote, and she just pulls out a bag of ballots and starts into the drop box. And it's absolutely wild. And so the idea that this sort of represents, like, you know, you're sort of feeling this vibe shift.
I was saying that you're talking about the specific election and who might win. I'm saying more broadly is that the polarization that I think we are seeing, we're certainly seeing it in the UK, with the way that if I think back to when I was in my early 20s, there was no problem with a person that voted Conservative, but a person that voted Labour being friends. There was no problem with them dating each other. That most women voted Labour, for God's sake. I mean, this was how it was. And now we're seeing this polarization effect whereby I go to these conferences, these right-wing conferences, which used to be entirely male. And now, okay, from a small base, but nevertheless, more females. It's as though wokeness is saying to you, you're either with us or you're evil. If you're evil, of course, you're going to react against it. You're going to siphon yourself off separately from the mainstream, as is happening, with even with something that's as
The mainstream, the mainstream is evil and has been for a long time.
Yeah, but it's, well, you know, it's more in your face and openly so. Mm-hmm. Once it's telling people, you know, we're going to prosecute some working class white person for a silly comment on Twitter or whatever, it's just absolutely saying we hate you and we're going to bludgeon you into submission because we hate you, and this is, and we're going to lie to you, and we're going to show you mixed race relationships as normal on TV all the time, and we're going to show you all this stuff, all this, just this clown world, in order to demoralize you and humiliate you. And I'm afraid that some people, young people, increasingly have a rebellious streak, reacting against this. It makes one think that there would be some sort of, well, there is evidence of it on the data, some sort of polarization which is happening. That people who are Generation Z, normally you're predictably more left-wing if you're 20 than you are when you're 40, because you become more right-wing with age. And this is breaking down. Generation Z are the most left-wing generation ever, obviously, but they're not as left-wing as they should be in relation to the 40, which implies polarization, which implies... And I'm wondering how you see that in America. How can America be sustained?
Well, I feel American can be sustained very easily. You might ask how the Soviet Union could be sustained in 1965. It turns out that it could be sustained very easily, and the very, very easily. And, you know, I think that we're, you know, there's a sort of tendency in conservatism, horrible, horrible tendency, to kind of see yourself as a tipping point. You know, you're just like, things are about to change, we're about to win, we're winning, whatever. You know, not only are we not going to get tired of winning, Professor Dutton, like, we haven't even started losing yet. We haven't even started losing. And like, the losing has just begun. And so when you're basically seeing Herr Starmer, you know, did you call him Herr Starmer?
I'm happy to call him that.
Herr Starmer. Herr Starmer, the Czechoslovak, you know.
The man who has no dreams, the man who has no favorite novel, the man who has no favorite poem.
I love it.
The man who keeps away from the dark alleyways of his own unconscious. The man who was parentalized by his parents, clearly the man who just this poor man. Really.
And I was just reading, he wet himself actually at the age of 10. That's also quite remarkable, you know. And then as a teenager, he went to a summer camp sponsored by the Czechoslovak Secret Service, the notorious STB. So, you know, I'm not saying, I mean, if he'd been to a Hitler Youth work camp, you know, if Nigel Farage, you know, had, like, you know, worked with the Falange in Castro's regime, in Franco's regime, you know, I think that would be a thing. But of course, you know, turnabout is not fair play. I mean, that's what, you know, Tutir Kier, I believe, would say. And yeah, no, you know, this form of tyranny is an accelerating spiral. The logic only increases. it needs its own logic, and it tends to spiral inward rather quickly and rather easily. And so, you know, it's like my wife was a little apprehensive about going to Paris and London because, you know, you're like, well, what's going on in France? Well, Pavel Durov of Telegram just got arrested for running a peer-to-peer chat service. I run a peer-to-peer chat service of sorts, in a way. And then I'm going to England, where people get arrested for saying naughty things on the internet. Have I said naughty things on the internet? Have you said naughty things on the internet?
I think, first of all, I don't live in England. But second of all, I seem to...
Well, we're here now,
aren't we not? That is true. But I seem to phrase them in a way that doesn't...
Yes, you know, and so, you know, the phrasing, and especially who you're speaking to, is especially important. This is why I caution everyone against any sort of populism, because when you're invoking populism, you're saying, I'm against the powers that be. I don't want to be against the powers that be. I want to seduce the powers that be. And I want to show them a good time. I want to say, come over to the dark side.
You want to get, you want to get to that party with those fit birds.
Sorry?
You want to get them to that party with those fit birds.
And that's right. Earlier. That birds is an English expression for the crowd. Yes, that's exactly what I want, and you'll notice, and it works. If you throw the best parties, people want to come to your parties, you know, and that's why, you know, to the extent that I would never want to start a political party in the sense of a political party, but in the sense of a party, absolutely, good parties are very, very important.
So now, before we continue, I'd like to tell you about something quite exciting. I'm sure you're all familiar with the book The Bell Curve by Richard Herrnstein and Charles Murray, a book which got them thoroughly cancelled in 1994. Why? Because it was extremely based. It dared to look at race differences in IQ, class differences in IQ, and all kinds of other fascinating stuff. You should read it. But the problem is, it's over 1,000 pages long. And I know that you Generation Z people, you don't particularly like reading. You're very, very busy. But that is why you should use Legiont.com, because Legiont.com will summarize based books in 25 minutes or less, and then it will read them to you. Legiont.com will basically inject the basedness right from your phone into your brain. So, Legiont.com, chaps, and if you sign up with the promotion code TJH, you'll get 10% off. Legiont.com, basedness from your phone to your brain box.
So when you say, as you see it, I mean, I know I've looked at this in terms of the genetics, in terms of various other factors, but why do you think that since the 80s, basically, we have descended gradually into, or 90s, we have descended in the West gradually into...
Which 80s or 90s?
Talking about the 1980s.
I thought you meant the 1780s. Sorry,
well, yeah. Perhaps we can put it back that far. But to be fair, at that time, there were kind of blasphemy laws and things like that. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that once we get to the 1990s or 1980s, there's the restrictions that are brought about by the Christian society have basically died, and the restrictions that we now have brought about by the sort of woman politically correct gay society have not ascended yet. So as you see it, why have we allowed ourselves to descend into tyranny in the West?
Why would we not allow ourselves? I mean, you know, there's all sorts of terrible mythos that are sort of holding us back from any kind of effective action. And, you know, the mythos is like, let me give you two examples of this mythos. And I fear, you know, it seems in your optimism. Who was it? Was it Nietzsche who said that optimism is cowardice? And I believe very strongly that optimism is cowardice. And so I would urge you to set aside your cowardice and look reality in the face. And let me give you two very specific examples of that. One of them is the Tea Party, meaning, of course, the second Tea Party, not the original Antifa mob destroying private property in the 1770s. But the Tea Party of the early 2000s. Are you familiar? Remember the Tea Party? Yes. And the other is the Gilets Jaunes in France just before the start of COVID. And both of them had essentially the same property, which is the property of... Are you familiar with the word LARPing?
Yes.
And it refers to live action role playing. It refers to, more generally, the word has been expanded to mean any kind of sort of real participation in a false narrative. And the false narrative here, let's take the Gilets Jaunes, for example. The Gilets Jaunes had this wonderful idea of, you know, that a demonstration, which of course is the way to create change in a democracy, that a demonstration would be cooler and much more effective if everyone brought their own matching uniform. Can't remember where I've heard that one before. And so all of these Frenchmen, you know, defending traditional France, you know, non-gay marriage, children, no abortion, Catholicism, whatever they believe in, you know, hundreds of thousands of people get dressed up in their yellow traffic vests, the Gilets Jaunes, and, you know, they all know one thing. According to the history books they have studied, France is governed by the people. And the way you create political change in France is to get a large number of people together at the same time and to have a demonstration. They get a large number of people together at the same time and they have a demonstration. And are you familiar with, you know, the classic example of LARPing is, are you familiar with the concept of the cargo cult?
Indeed.
So let me explain for readers or viewers who don't, you know the history of the cargo cults, in, because this is the premier example of LARPing. In World War II, in occupying, in our war to save California from the deadly Japanese, the deadly and impending Japanese invasion, we had to occupy, for our reasons, all of these Pacific islands, and who were inhabited by very, very primitive, you know, Denisovan-descended Melanesian peoples. And
Aboriginal
peoples. And they saw with amazement that all these planes from America landed and dispensed cargo, all kinds of good stuff, spam, everything, right? And how did you summon these planes? And it was discovered that you summoned these planes by stepping out on a long, open stretch of land and waving with orange paddles. And so after the war ended, some enterprising natives had the idea that they could summon the cargo back, because the cargo had vanished because VJ Day, that they could summon this cargo by waving orange paddles. And they waved orange paddles and then nothing happened. So they had to have some kind of theological reason why nothing happened. They weren't waving paddles hard enough, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so the Gilets Jaunes, or the Tea Party, go out and they get a demonstration. They get a large group of people together and protest the government. And
but to the extent that, to the
and
extent,
nobody cares.
I know, of course, but to the extent that I'm an optimistic coward, this is because they don't understand how power works. They don't understand Pareto. They don't understand Mosca. They don't understand the dynamics of power, which is that you have it is a fight among the elites, and the elites will co-opt as their coalition the mob or whatever, or a kind.
Well, I mean, yeah, sure. I mean, but the thing is, you know, they're sort of failing to understand why we got democracy at all. We got democracy at all because the power of a mob is absolutely tremendous. So in a way, I might say that England, you know, 500 years ago...
It's the power of a directed mob.
It's the power of a violent mob.
Right,
and
directed.
So directed, well, yes, but even an undirected mob, nobody was directing the mob that stormed the Bastille. You know, not exactly. You know, it's true that there's a kind of alliance in
they
a
were,
sense
were
but,
the
between the
being...
philosophes and the mob. But the mob is not a mob of educated people. But if you basically look at, say, you know, the London mob 500 years ago, the way they operated was a rumor might go around that the German merchants in the steelyard were undercutting true-born Englishmen in the wool trade. And the apprentices of London had a very simple idea as how to solve that problem, which would have appealed, you know, perhaps to, you know, Vansittart or Winston Churchill. They were just like, let's kill all the Germans. And they would do that, or they would do their best to do that, and there wasn't really a force that could particularly stop them.
But there were forces within the elite that didn't really want to stop them. I actually quite liked the idea.
That didn't actually the state, you know, England, you know, one of the
Antifa is a thug, is a mob.
Yeah. But the thing is, you know, the Antifa are young lords, really. They're the jeunesse dorée, but they're not like, you know, the common people at all. But I think you're missing an important difference and the important difference is the domestication of the population, because I think that it is almost impossible. For, you know, when was the last time you were in a fist fight?
Last night with Nina Power.
I know. I was seeing that little mark on your cheek, and I was just like, you should see Nina. But exactly. How many men have you killed? You know, and so you know, in a world in which, and we know as an evolutionary anthropologist, we know the statistics for European on European crime. In London 500 years ago, these were violent people.
Everybody carried a knife.
And so when the mob, you know, storms the Bastille, even the, you know, the original Tea Party, nobody was harmed, but they were ready to do harm. You know, the American Revolution was carried out by these people. Actually, they had two kinds of capacity. One is that they were very good at spontaneous organization. They would spontaneously form militias, committees of correspondence, Sons of Liberty. The Sons of Liberty are, well, they're not quite as violent as ISIS, but, you know, tarring and feathering, that's, you know, people write about tarring and feathering and say, oh, yeah, we tarred and feathered the, you know, do you know what tarring and feathering? Yes, right. And so the thing is, basically, the missing ingredient when you assemble 400,000 people in Paris in yellow vests, you're assembling 399,000 sheep and maybe 1,000, you know, rough gentlemen.
Well, the people that follow Tommy Robinson, they're prepared to do violence, but they're badly led. They're prepared to do
a tiny amount of violence, and they're easily overpowered by the riot police. They're very easily overpowered and kettled. And what we see actually in the world of Herr Sturmer, or what we see in, for example, the repression of the Hong Kong democratic movement, is that it is absolutely trivial for a modern state to repress any kind of popular agitation with, you know, not only are the people vastly weaker than before because they're prepared to surround the presidential palace, they're prepared to go into the Capitol building. But what do? There, they take pictures, they stay inside the velvet ropes, maybe they put their feet up on the desk, and they get 4 years for putting their feet up on the desk. And their faces are all identified by face recognition. And they learn very quickly not to do that stuff. And so, and that's what we're going to learn, you're learning already in the UK as a result of these riots. A riot is an anti-government demonstration. A true demonstration is a government-organized demonstration, such as they used to have in the Eastern Bloc. You know, the spontaneous movement of the proletarian people in favor of the, you know, freedom in South Africa or something. That's a real demonstration, not a riot. Right. And that's a very peaceful thing. And they'll even do like fake arrests. It's amazing. It's a different kind of LARPing. But the thing is, you know, if you see power, you know, what I see in the latest, you know, riots, apparently, you know, these were anti-Welsh riots, as you know, because you know, three young girls were stabbed by a Welshman. Right. You know, Taffy was a Welshman. Taffy was a thief. I mean, it's been a problem for a long time, frankly. You know, it's about time that, you know, true-born Englishmen took a stance against the Welshman. And you know what the word Welsh means, right? It means foreigner in Anglo-Saxon, right? You know, and so this Welshman comes to England. It was England, not Scotland, right? And he gets very stabby.
He did.
As the Welsh do, right? You know, and is this an anti-Welsh? Can I be anti-Welsh on this podcast?
Eating too many leeks.
They get stabby. They're like catnip. Yes. For the Welshman, you know, and he gets very stabby. And so you have these anti-Welsh, you know, protests. And of course, the Welsh power is very strong in the government. It's the Welsh, the International Welsh Conspiracy.
The Welsh
Yeah, exactly. The International Welsh Conspiracy. IWC, and the government refuses to deal with its Welsh problem, and so you get these spontaneous anti-Welsh protests, right? And riots is a good thing. That's, you protest climate change. You know, imagine what would happen to Tommy Robinson and his lads, you know, if he decided to block motorways by, you know, chaining himself to the road or gluing himself to the road or something. They'd probably just rip his hands off, you know, and I don't know that they'd rip his hands off, but like it would not be very effective, and it would result in long prison terms. And so even the idea, when you see, you know, these protests against climate change, what is it, revolution, what is the latest? The latest, greatest.
It's called Extinction Rebellion.
Extinction Rebellion, the latest, greatest public school revolt. You know, Extinction Rebellion, you know, I'm sure consists almost entirely of old Etonians, you know, posh girls from Eton, right? You know, and couldn't be more different from Mr. Yaxley Lennon. And the, you know, of course, the effect of their protests is considerable. They're creating change, Professor Dutton. They're creating real change. Posh girls can create posh real girls, change. Posh, right. Posh and so, you know, what we see is basically, you know, and I like the analogy. I think one of the best analogies to the modern global American empire superstate is really the Roman Empire, and especially the later Roman Empire. Because, as you know, in the Roman Republic, sort of popular, the turbulence of popular movements, popular elections, et cetera, mm-hmm. is a meaningful force. It's a factor that is very meaningful. You know, the mob fights of Milo and Clodius, you know, in the closing days of the Republic, you know, men are torn asunder by the mob. And, you know, what we see as the Roman Empire advances is we see as the Roman Empire gets worse and worse and more tyrannical, any notion of resisting power or affecting power with like popular militias, movements,
no, it mobs, becomes whatever. Chaotic, and the result is
it, no, it doesn't become chaotic. It becomes it develops a world of absolute submission.
No, that's my point. It became chaotic, and the result was then a world of absolute submission.
That's right. That's right. That's right. You know, it became chaotic under the later Republic, and then the result was the Caesars, who basically restored Rome, but, you know, led on this kind of downward slope toward tyranny, as we would call it now.
Tyranny, but eventually, I would argue, but we've got data on this actually from genomes, ancient genomes. They were becoming less intelligent. And eventually the whole system.
Are you telling me that the rivers of Orontes flowed into the Tiber?
I don't know what that, I don't get the reference.
It's a quote from Juvenal. And, you know, this is actually, I'm just confirming the genomic, you know. So, you know, we see the rise of these Eastern mystery cults, mm-hmm. for example, yes. in the mid to later empire. And what both, you know, the actual writing of antiquity and modern scholarship have confirmed is that the Roman population is largely replaced by servile immigrants brought in
from the East. Two kinds of things, immigrants, and then Ovid commented on the fact that the upper-class men weren't having children.
Yes, and they tried very hard to replace. And that's, of course, happening in our society as well. Augustus tried very hard to reverse, with the Lex Popio Poppaea, you know, Augustus tried very hard to reverse this, no success. So we're seeing that as well.
But then eventually, that's my point, that when you're pessimistic, I'm a coward, but eventually you get this collapse as a result of that, and this breakup.
We have elite overproduction. You know, the collapse, you know, actually you need very few aristocrats. And, you know, the collapse happens, like, you know, the collapse is a couple of interesting things. I mean, to me, the fundamental question of our time, Professor Dutton, is whether we're living in the late Roman Republic or the late Roman Empire. And anyone who says we're living in the late Roman Republic is an optimist. And anyone who thinks that we're living in the late Roman Empire is a pessimist. And I would love to be living in the late Roman Republic.
No, I'd love to be living in the late Roman Empire, because that would be then the collapse. And then perhaps something could be come out of the ashes.
Well, you know, are you familiar with the word, Professor Dutton? Are you familiar with the work of Gildas?
Yes, I am.
And so Gildas, late in the Roman Empire, one of the things that basically people expect in a collapse that they will be most fatally disappointed in is they basically see this global empire and they expect the old polities, when this global power collapses, they expect the old polities to reassert themselves. They expect secession. They expect new local power structures to spring up. And, you know, in the decline of the Roman Empire, and the Roman Empire, you know, is not so much, does not so much fall to the barbarians as it is scavenged by the barbarians. It dies of its own causes. The barbarians who eventually invade the empire, a shadow of the barbarians who Caesar defeated. And, you know, you would expect, if you thought like one of these conservatives who, you know, the kind of optimism you've expressed is a very special kind of optimism. I call it doomer optimism. And the doomer optimist looking at the late Roman Empire would see this super state, which originally, you know, in the early days of the Roman Empire, you know, the chains of empire are quite weak. And a city in the empire is typically a former city state, which now has no, which still governs itself. It's still governed by the local aristocrats. And the only thing that's changed is it has no foreign policy and no military. So it's like Europe today, right? And the, I guess there's still token militaries in Europe, but come on, you know, and certainly no independent foreign policy. That's
Are you ready for the future of the West?